This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. For years, I have subscribed to this investment newsletter from the Aiden sisters, Pamela and Marianne. It's called the Aiden Forecast, and they are underwriters of our program right now, to put that out there. And but it's just been a great source of information for Louise and I for I think several decades, at least, you know, well over a decade anyway. And so I'm really pleased to have on the air with us right now Marianne and Pamela Aiden, the co-editors and publishers of the Aiden Forecast and directors of Aiden Research. AidenForecast.com is the website. You can tweet them at the Aiden Forecast. Marianne, Pamela, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so I'm curious where you think the economy is at right now from the point of view of small investors, of people who have a little bit of money that they want to protect or they want to see grow. And I realize those might be different strategies, whether it's, or for that matter, you know, a young person. I was telling Nate the other day, you know, start taking $100 every other week out of your paycheck and just stick it in the stock market someplace and don't worry about it for 30 years. So where are we at right now?
Well, actually, we're in a good place, and the economy does look good. It keeps looking better, even though some people will argue, well, it's been such a long recovery or a long period of expansion that it's got to contract. But so far, the leading indicators that we follow are not showing that. One being the stock market is very bullish. In fact, it's just recently been hitting even further, all of them, hitting new record highs. And we have a Dow Theory reconfirmation of the bull market. And since stocks generally lead the economy by about 6 months to a year, it's telling us that the economy looks good. In addition, we do not have an inverted yield curve, and that's very good for the economy, and leading economic indicators keep rising. So, and there's other things too, but those are some key indicators that we follow that have been very, very reliable over the years, and they're all telling us that the economic expansion has further to run.
I was reading Andrew Ross Sorkin's deal book in the New York Times this morning. I get an email every day, along with the Daily Pfennig from, what's his name, on your staff, or who writes for you?
Yes, Chuck Butler.
Chuck, that's right, yeah. And Sorkin was talking about how there's been, so far this year, something like $81 billion in stock buybacks. Just from, I think it was just Apple, it was like $80 billion in stock buybacks, and that all of these stock buybacks that are being done, and that they're probably going to total over $1 trillion by the middle of next year when this cycle will probably be done. It's been going on for about a year. Are the result of the massive tax cuts, corporate tax cuts that the Trump administration passed, and that it's like pouring ether into the carburetor of a car. I mean, you just it's a sugar high. You're jacking this thing, and the question is, how long will that last before it gets really ugly? And yesterday in Chuck's newsletter, he was talking about how there are a number of leading indicators like new home purchases, used home purchases. I don't remember the list now, that are actually have gone negative in the last few months. Are we kind of at a knife's edge point, or is that stimulus and the tax cut and whatnot going to last for long enough that people should feel comfortable jumping into the market, in your opinion?
Well, what's interesting is that even though the bull market's been underway since 2009, and it's a very long one, it's not the end. We think that the third wave is usually the last most explosive wave in the stock market, bull market, or any major bull market for that matter. And we think we're on the cusp of that still. Hmm. So we still have a good upside, but if you want to think of it in the terms of an inning in a baseball game, we would think we're like in the seventh, eighth inning, and still a lot of upside, but we're closer to the end than the beginning, but we still have some good upside, say this year and next year.
So you're...
And I just wanted to add, Tom, that it's true the things Chuck reports are a little worrisome. The numbers you point out are worrisome, but there's always some, all along there's been some worrisome things, but the stronger good news kind of has overpowered those worrisome items.
Right. Go ahead.
We don't hear you very well, but the resource sector is just starting to get off, which is telling us the global economy is doing okay in spite of all the bad news this year. Mm-hmm. We're just starting to see the resources come out of hibernation. They've been very down, and they're very bombed out, in fact. But we're just starting to see a whisper of that now come this recently, and we think that could be the beginning of a new trend.
You've recommended in the newsletter that people get some of the tech stocks. You know, specifically, you could buy the ETF for the Standards & Poor's, for the S&P, or Apple, or Google. Some of these companies. I got stopped out of Google. Are there specific recommendations, or is that too specific, and we really should deal with this in generalities?
No, in general, if someone wants to ride the bull market and the major trend, which continues to be up, then something like DIA, which is the ETF for the Dow Industrials, QQQ for the NASDAQ trends, also the IYT for the Dow Jones Transportation, those have been very good. They move with the market, and someone could do very well, knowing, though, that you have to be cautious, keep a stop on your position, and just keep an eye out, because you're probably buying maybe for a year, maybe 2 years at most, but this is not something you're going to hold for the long, long term, at least for most people.
Unless you're under 40?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I was thinking of that. If you're young and can ride it through, definitely that's the place just to sit and then keep some of your money.
Yeah, yeah. It just, look at Warren Buffett and what he has done. People who have actually created by just small investments throughout their lives, starting in their 30s, and by the time they're in their 60s, they're retiring with a whole lot. Marianne and Pamela, any final thoughts for us on investment in the markets?
Well, really just kind of stay, let the market tell you what to do rather than you trying to tell the market. That's kind of an important rule, because we all have opinions and we all have reasons why, stocks shouldn't be going up, or there's, a little bit of, ups and downs in the political scene, or there's some negatives on the economy. But if the market keeps heading up, which it has been, and even though it's been long in the tooth, just stay with it.
Yeah. Okay. Marianne and Pamela Aden, the Aden sisters, the co-editors and publishers of the Aden Forecast, directors of Aden Research. AdenForecast.com is the website. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Great talking with you both. I really appreciate it. And always learn something from these two women. Back to the Supreme Court and the Constitution. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to argue that the actual justices, the Republican justices on the Supreme Court, do not actually follow the Constitution. Nowhere is the word corporation mentioned in the Constitution, but they do mention the word welfare. And that is what I just cannot, for the life of me, for these originalists, textualists, whatever they want to ist themselves, it doesn't add up, and it's very hypocritical.
Yeah. No, originalism is a scam, and textualism is a scam. These words were invented in the 1980s when they were trying to pack the court with Robert Bork type, what today we would refer to as, Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist. Well, Rehnquist wasn't even that crazy. Alito. Now you've got Kavanaugh types, and they were like, we can't just start overturning things that people like. We can't just blow up Social Security and Medicare and say, ta-da, look at what we did. We've got to have a reason. We've got to have a rationalization. And so they came up with this, well, we're interpreting the original intent of the founders. And after all, they're like demigods. You wouldn't want to, say something nasty about the founders, would you? So that's what's going on, Albert.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Tom. And for the Republicans out there, Like, can some of them call in and tell us why they believe in this?
That would be a good one. That would be a very good one. Albert, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks so much for listening to the program. It's a scam. I mean, that's just what it boils down to. And they are willing to put up with charges of his being a gang rapist. I mean, seriously? You have Brett Kavanaugh saying, oh, you know, the drinking age was 18, so the seniors were legal. I'm sorry. When he was 17 years old, the drinking age in Maryland went up to 21. He lied on Fox News last night.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Of course, he lied in his first Senate confirmation hearing. He lied in his second Senate confirmation hearing. And, you know, what's to say he's not lying now? Well, pretty much nothing. Let's see here. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, David, thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
Hi. I wanted to bring up a little bit of ancient history here. This is after World War One, and General Pershing and other members of the military went to various members of Congress and said, look, we cannot, most of these people that came in for the draft were 4F. We have to have childhood nutrition because they came in with flat feet and rickets. We need compulsory education because nobody could sign. They couldn't read or write. They could only sign an X. And they said, we cannot defend our country if we were ever invaded. And then they were going to panic. I don't remember exactly historical reference that brought that up, but that is one of the basis of why we have compulsory education and that we have childhood nutrition. And this is just kind of gone by the wayside, that whole argument.
And this went back to General Pershing?
Back to Pershing. Well, Pershing and this is after World War One.
Right.
And
if you could find a link for that, David, I was unaware of that history. I've heard stories to that effect that, you know, a lot of our social welfare programs came out of a desire to have a strong military.
We couldn't defend our country. Is that there were so many people that came in that when they issued the draft, that they were throwing out like 3 out of 5 people were saying 4F.
Right.
You know, you can't carry a pack. Because remember, you have rural farms where nutrition was horrible. And, you know, the little schoolhouse that everybody loves to remember, well, you know, it was only if somebody actually had their kids go to that schoolhouse.
Right.
There was nothing compulsory about it. And if there even was a schoolhouse.
Yep. So what I was saying, David, is I have not heard as concise a definition of it as you just did, and I'm very grateful to you for that. If you could find any links to historical documents that lay that out or prove that, I would love to see them. You could tweet them to me.
Yeah, I've actually kind of been looking back because I remember reading it, and I've kind of just been going back, and I just for the life of me can't remember where I saw that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the Smedley Butler thing about the men who tried to take over FDR, well, one of the things about that helped with the Supreme Court was that essentially Roosevelt went to Mellon and Ford and all these people that were behind that conspiracy and said, look, you got your choice. You either back me in my New Deal or I'm going to have you tried as traitors.
Right. Do you think he, I've never seen any evidence that he went that far. In fact, he shut down a congressional inquiry into this because he didn't want,
right.
You know, he was afraid it could provoke a civil war, essentially.
I got that impression out of reading Smedley Butler's book that
But FDR never met with Smedley Butler.
No, he never met, but it was kind of implied in that book.
Yeah, yeah.
That he was given that, and he went.
You're talking about Butler's book, War is a Racket?
Well, no, there's a second book called The Plot to Overthrow FDR.
Right, okay. Yeah, I'll have to, it's been a long time since I dug into this stuff. David, thank you. Thanks for a great history lesson this morning. I hope that we can find some General Pershing links. I would love to see them. And I could use that for a book I'm working on right now. I will remember. We'll be back with more of your calls in just a moment. Welcome back. Welcome back. David K. Johnston tweeting about Michael Avenatti. Michael Avenatti is saying, said last night basically on the Rachel Maddow show that he had witnesses and a victim to the essentially gang rapes that Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge were participants in. And Johnston is saying, you know, okay, if this is the case, how did this guy get past the FBI background checks? What did the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, know? Now, I think he knew about this because Mitch McConnell, you recall, was opposed to Kavanaugh. He went to the president and said, don't put this guy on the court, on the bench. There's stuff in his background. You know, put on somebody who we don't really know anything about. And but if this is proven, Kavanaugh, it's time for Kavanaugh to leave the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals as well. And you know, just go through this. And by the way, you know, get the FBI on this. It's just, you know, just this is just straightforward stuff. Chris in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was watching the locals on KSBW last night about Salinas and the police pulling over this guy that I don't understand why they pulled him over, but, you know, he ran from him in his car, right? He's trying to take off and escape. Mm-hmm. And the newscasters said that, you know, the cops shot him dead when they wanted to stop him before he got to a certain intersection, so they killed the guy. And then when they searched the car, no weapons found in the car. And I don't know, man. To me, this just seems like unadulterated murder.
I did not know that fleeing the police was. Right. I did not know that fleeing the police was a capital crime. That the death penalty was the.
Yeah, I thought they were judge, jury, and executioner in this case. Yeah. And then KSBW just, you know, they found no weapons on board for the guy that was running from the police, and that was the end of that issue. And I thought, well, what about the poor guy's rights?
Yeah, we've got a serious problem. Thanks for the heads up on that, Chris. I was unaware of that. We've got a serious problem with the police in this country, which is particularly problematic because typically when strongmen, you know, look at Duterte in the Philippines, take over a country, the first thing they do is get the cops on their side and then use them to beat up protesters and to intimidate people. And, you know, is Trump doing that? I don't know, but he certainly seems to be trying to. Claude in Monroe, New York. Claude, you're on the air. What's up?
How you doing, Professor? Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I just wanted to say something about Thomas Paine and the book that he wrote called Agrarian Justice.
Yeah.
He talks about a form of socialism in that book long before there was a Karl Marx. And I'm sure that you're aware of that, but I don't know how if your readers are.
Yeah.
Agrarian Justice, it talks about, he shows how the Native Americans didn't know what poverty was. They shared everything, and that people who use the land should pay a tax for that to help young people get a start in life or to old age retirement, and that kind of thing should be a tax on the land. I'm sure you're aware, because I know you're quite a historian.
Yeah, I've read Agrarian Justice. It's been 20, 30 years, but my recollection is that he proposed essentially Social Security. He proposed a minimum wage.
The founding father of the country.
Yeah.
Without Thomas Paine, there would never have been an America.
Yeah. Well, that
you know what I mean? But that should be required reading in every school.
Yes, I agree.
Instead, they're trying to take away people like Helen Keller. I just heard something the other day that they're going to take her out of the textbooks down in Texas. Are you kidding? Why?
Yeah.
Because she was one of the most liberal people, Helen Keller, who we all know, the blind, you know, she was famous for overcoming her blindness and deafness. But she was also one of the greatest speakers and advocates of progressive ideas.
Yes, she was.
And they're just trying to close it all down.
And down in Texas, they've put Rush Limbaugh in the textbooks.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that.
No, I'm serious.
Just one more note, Tom. I was at a friend of mine's 50th wedding anniversary the other day over at the West Point Hotel Fair. He had his party there. And, you know, unfortunately, I got a table there where some women just started carrying on about socialism, you know. And I my wife kept kicking me in the knee, you know, because she wanted to say so much at the party. But I couldn't believe this woman, the way she was carrying on. I just,
you got 15 seconds here if you want to tell a story, Claude.
You're uninformed. She goes, socialism is like the Nazis. I said, no, it has absolutely nothing to do with the Nazis. The Nazis are Nazis. Socialism is not what you're saying it is. You know, yeah. I realized I was definitely talking to someone who was not going to listen to a word I said. So
Somebody's been watching Fox News. I would say, okay, you know, you want to get rid of socialism? Let's see how that works. We'll get rid of Social Security. We'll get rid of Medicare. We'll get rid of the fire department. We'll get rid of the police department. We'll get rid of the public roads. You know, all that socialist stuff. We'll get rid of all the public schools. Sure. Yeah. How is that going to work out? Good one, Claude. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's talk media for the rest of us, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Bill Cosby just sentenced to 3 to 10 years for criminal sexual assault. Just bringing you up to date here on the news of the day. Senator Bob Corker has just come out and said that Republican men should not be questioning Dr. Blasey Ford, Christine Blasey Ford, because, quote, somebody will do something insensitive that you guys, the media, will run 24/7, and inadvertently somebody will do something that's insensitive. All right. Meanwhile, another classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's has come forward to say that he's lying through his teeth. It just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. Theo in New York City. Hey, Theo, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll show you in real time.
Thank you.
First time I got to show you, yeah. So I just wanted to make a comment. So basically, from my understanding, Trump won the presidency due to Caucasian women. Being that the fact that he said, you know, he grabbed pussy and all these comments, all these, you know, porn star.
Yeah, let's not, Theo, let's not use that word on the air if we can avoid it, okay?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
So, you know, they voted him in knowing that stuff. Okay, great, fine. All right. 2 years later, now we got this guy, Brett Kavanaugh, and now these allegations are coming up.
Yeah.
And now, all of a sudden, these same Caucasian women, you know, now who voted him in, are all up in arms over this. But what the heck did they think they were going to get when they voted Trump in? They think it was going to get better? And it's just, I'm a little pissed off. And it's like, yeah, this is what you get. You know, you made your bed, lie in it now. And I don't want to hear the complaints, because everybody who didn't vote him, we knew this. And from my understanding, he won because of Caucasian women, just like Obama did. You know, I don't know what they want, but I'm sorry, I'm not going to get up in arms. I mean, I'm pissed too, among other things, but it's just like a smack in the face. I mean, like, what do they think is going to happen when they do?
Yeah, and when Roe v. Wade goes away, they're going to be even more freaked out. And then when Social Security goes away, and then when public education goes away, and then when all kinds of, you know, virtually any kind of support for women and children, you know, as these programs go away, and they're not being characterized any longer. Everybody gets it. They're not being characterized as purely just for, you know, people of color, which was the way that, you know, Reagan and the first Bush, and to some extent Clinton, sold the destruction of these programs. There is some serious comeuppance is going to happen, Theo. I can't celebrate that, though. I think it's just a terrible, a disaster. Theo, thanks a lot for the call. Don in Northwest Indiana, it says you want to disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What are you going to disagree with me about?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you I do enjoy your show, even though I think some of your ideas are a little bit crazy and off the wagon.
Okay.
But I heard you just a couple of minutes ago saying you need to call for an FBI investigation into Kavanaugh because of these allegations, these unsubstantiated, unfounded allegations. Is that right? Is that what I heard?
No. What I'm saying and have been saying all along is if you lie to the FBI, you go to jail for 5 years.
If you're a Republican.
No matter what you are, you go to jail for 5 years. And I find it really interesting that Christine Blasey Ford is saying, I want to be interviewed by the FBI. She's saying, I want to be interviewed by the FBI. Last night on Fox News, they asked Kavanaugh, do you want to be interviewed by the FBI? And he refused to say yes. Now, he didn't say no, but he changed the subject, which is the same thing. So, and then you ask the Republicans in the Senate, well, should we bring the FBI in? We did this with Clarence Thomas. It took all of 3 days to have 35 FBI agents fan out and interview hundreds of people to clear Clarence Thomas.
Tom, let me make my point, okay?
Sure.
Because
you have
the microphone and you get to make your point as long as you want. First of all, I'll go dollar for dollar for any donation to any charity that you want that Mrs. Ford doesn't show up to testify Thursday because she feels unsafe already, despite the fact that the Congress made every attempt to even fly to her to let her give her story. But second of all, I wanted to go back, and you kind of did. You pulled the liberal move. You muddied the water and didn't ask the question I asked you. The question I asked you was, you want the FBI to investigate Kavanaugh, correct, for these allegations?
I think that the women who are asking to be investigated.
Tom, it's a yes or no question. You want the FBI to investigate Kavanaugh, correct?
And the women who are alleging he was abusive toward them, yes.
How many investigations will they do into that man before your side is happy with this?
Well, they haven't done any investigations so far. What they've done so far are background checks, and that's a whole different thing.
No, it's not a whole different thing. They've gone to everyone that lived within the proximity of him his entire life.
It had never been alleged that he had committed a crime, so there was never a criminal investigation.
You think they don't investigate those people for that when they're applying for those judgeships?
They do if somebody comes forward, but this is the kind of thing that people typically don't come forward for. Don, you know, go back to Fox News. Jonathan in Portland. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I was listening to your discussion about the stock market earlier, and I just want to share a couple thoughts. You may know that Isaac Newton had invested
in the South Seas Corporation,
got wiped out. Yeah, and well, he made a lot of money actually initially on the slave trade, and then he lost $3 million because he got greedy.
Yep.
So it just made me think, like, you know, no matter how smart you are, you can get burned.
Yes. Yeah, and that's why I don't know if it was Pamela or Marianne, but they said be sure to put stops in. And, you know, for people who don't know what that is, when you buy a stock through your broker, you can tell your broker, if you do it online, you know, with Fidelity or whatever, you can just click right. the link and you can say, okay, I'm buying this stock at 110. If it goes below 105, automatically sell it.
Right. I just wanted to point out an interesting piece of information that I came across.
Sure.
I am personally not comfortable investing in the stock market for moral reasons. But I'm also noticed something very interesting. If you look at the market since the crash of 2008, you compare the S&P 500 with probably the biggest multi-sector bond fund, which is PIMCO, PIMIX, P-I-M-I-X.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually look at the return. There's a great website called Portfolio Visualizer, and you'll see that they both come out even.
Mm-hmm.
And the bond fund has a fraction of the volatility. You know, we're talking about compound annual growth rate. We're not talking about annualized returns, which is really not a fair way of mm-hmm. looking at rates of return. But you look at a standard deviation of 4% for bonds versus 14% for the market, which is a lot of volatility for people to tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think bonds in general, if you're looking at investing in municipalities, I mean, you may not morally agree with what the bonds are doing, but when I look at what's going on, you know, in Wells Fargo and with the drug companies, and I just have a big problem in investing in the stock market,
yeah.
even though there's this idea that I might make some money.
I get it, Jonathan, and I think you're right. And in fact, I have a little bit of money in an Oregon municipal fund, bond fund, because you know, A, it's tax free. B, you know, they're paying a steady 2% or 3% or whatever it is, and it's a great and safe place to put your money. The Aiden sisters actually, up until about a year ago, were saying. Keep your money in the bond, and there were, you know, bond funds and whatnot, TLT and whatnot, that they were suggesting. But Jonathan, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Tom, I have a thought here that has bugged me since my civics classes in college. That you know as well as I that basically the Supreme Court has designated itself as a indirect 9-person king court, king and queen court, I would guess. And what has bothered me is what does it take to balance this third branch of our government again?
Right.
And I mean, this would be a rework of our Constitution conceptually, but at the same time, it might be a return to the Constitution. So, you know, is in place or what can be put in place to say, you know, what conceptually to me, any piece of legislation that is developed can go to the Supreme Court and die.
That's correct.
By their whims. So what will it take to stop them from saying, okay, we disagree with this piece of legislation and that's the end of it?
I think that what we have to do is depoliticize the court, Jeff, and that's a structural fix, and which is something Congress can do. Congress has the absolute right to regulate the Supreme Court. And so I think that if we were to establish an 18-year term limit, or someplace between 16 and 20-year term limit for the court, if you were to roll that out on a staggered basis, like we rolled out for the, you know, the Senate in the very first years, a staggered basis, so now every 2 years we vote on one-third of the Senate because they're six-year terms. That way, pretty much every president would appoint the same number of people to the Supreme Court, and reaching the number of maximum number of years. You still have a very insulated court. It's a long enough period of time that it crosses a generation or nearly. That would be a great start. I've been, you know, beating the drum for years and years that, like many of the European countries, we should not, you know, our Supreme Court should not be able to participate in judicial review and have judicial supremacy. This is the what Anita called earlier. Whoop, what just happened to my microphone? Oh, okay. This is what Anita called about a little earlier, and we were talking about. But I think that that's a starting point. Does that make sense, Jeff?
And I hear the music, so I'll be quick. But in a context, though, what is the purpose of the Supreme Court if not to be, executing judicial opinion?
Well, the main purpose, as outlined in the Constitution, is to be the final court of appeals. You know, the buck has to stop somewhere on every debate, and that's the Supreme Court's job.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And they did that a lot in the early years, by the way. They were referred to as the chickens and dogs court because there were so many farmers who were coming to the court wanting to litigate against somebody who's ate their chickens. And welcome back. And here we go. Don in Berkeley, California. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi there. You were just talking to the Aiden sisters and you know, saying how things are doing well, and I can't really argue that consumer sentiment just came out, and it's like pretty much it's close to the all-time high. It's just below the high of the 2000s,
right.
And you know what happened in the 2000s,
yep.
With the bust and everything. So, frankly, I'm moving my money. Not real fast, but just move my money slowly out of the market over to safer instruments. But
yeah, which is probably very wise. Pamela and Marianne are usually right, and they've been in their last newsletter in particular filled with warnings. You know, be very careful. Be sure to every stock you own has a stop on it. And in fact, I had a little bit of Google stock, and every week or so, and it was going up and up and up, and every week I'd raise that stop. So when it ended up stopping out, I had actually made a little bit of money on it. But
you're smarter than most.
Well, it's just, you know, most of us don't. I this is the first time I've done anything like that ever. And in retrospect, I really shouldn't be doing that. I don't have the time. You know, this is.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Yeah. Don, thanks for the call. Good talking to you. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Michael in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yeah, I was watching the speech. You were on the air, so I'm sure you didn't get a chance to see it. Michelle Obama was giving a speech at a Las Vegas high school.
I had the CEO of her organization on the show.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, today. In the first hour at 45 minutes after 12 Eastern time. And
I recorded it. I haven't had a chance to watch it, but she had these people so riled up, you know, that she almost couldn't give a speech. And I thought, well, her kids are grown. If she ran for president, she's got Barack behind her. She's got these people, you know, the young people coming up. And with all of the backing that she would have, I really think that we could accomplish a lot.
Well, you know, she's a young woman. And yeah. I think that if you look at Hillary Clinton's trajectory, she understood that just being the wife of a president is not something you can run on, and at least not for president. But being the wife of a president is something you can run on for the United States Senate. And if Michelle Obama was to run for the Senate from Illinois, or, you know, wherever they happen to have their permanent residence. And New York is very accommodating to that, although I don't know about, you know, what's coming open. But, you know, that's what Hillary Clinton did. She ran for the Senate, and then after she left the Senate, she became the Secretary of State. She comported herself well in all those positions, by and large, you know, outside of her Iraq war vote, which she apologized for. And then you say, you know, this person actually can run a country. I've watched them, you know, be part of running a country. So now I can trust that. I think if Michelle Obama doesn't do something like that, she's just going to be, you know, the ex-First Lady of the United States.
Well, the reason that I had thought, you know, in those lines, as far as, excuse me, as far as her running was because when she and Barack would go somewhere, she always seemed to get the most applause, whereas I don't remember ever seeing that with Hillary and Bill.
Yeah. No, I think she's a very gifted speaker and maybe a brilliant politician. It's just that, you know, when you're somebody's running for president, you need to know that they really know what they're doing. Michael, thank you for the call. So let's check in with it's Luke Vargas today, right? With Talk Media News. He's usually camped out at the United Nations. He's headquartered at the United Nations. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Loving What You Do, Alan Ratner's new book. And Luke, what is going on in the UN today? I understand, I watched it actually, our president claimed that he had done more than FDR, and everybody, I don't know if it was everybody, but it sure looked like, you know, a lot of the audience just started laughing at him.
I have to say that one moment.
Sorry, wrong hybrid. There we go.
Tommy, can you?
Yeah, try it again, Luke.
Well, I will say, I mean, I think that comment you're referring to, which is that President Trump takes to the stage and he says, you know...
Luke, you're really faint. Can you speak louder or get closer to the microphone?
Try this.
There we go. Okay, thank you.
So the first thing, basically, that President Trump says, he gets on stage and he says, in my 2 years in office, we have achieved more than almost any administration in the history of my country. And there's sort of a pause, and Trump totally set himself up for this. And the sentiments of the room, in a beautiful way, just reveal themselves immediately. And you start to hear people talking, a little laughter breaks out, and Trump senses this. And he says, oh, okay, that's how you feel. I didn't expect that. And then I think that gives everybody the occasion to actually, you know, voice how they're truly feeling. He sort of normalized the back and forth between the men on the podium and the folks in the audience.
Now, this is an applause line for him when he's doing stump speeches.
It's true. And
so he was expecting applause.
He was. So much of this speech really feels like it was hitting on points that are highlights of the Trump rally, you know, in Kalamazoo or, you know, Wheeling, West Virginia, wherever he, you know, whenever he does these things, he had repeated points in this speech where he was bashing sort of the globalized consensus on things. And it was a speech that I sort of informally titled, you know, No Apologies. He basically addressed all of the things that countries are complaining about, you know, regarding U.S. policy, complaining about us pulling out of the Paris deal, complaining about our separation of children from their parents at the border, our lack of sort of sympathy for the global refugee issue, our pullout from the U.N. Human Rights Council, our dissing of the International Criminal Court. And he sort of seemed to turn those issues around against his critics and say, A, I don't care about your criticism, and B, here's why we did that. So, for instance, let's say on sort of U.S.-Mexico border policy, you'd never sense that we just had a year where, you know, images of children separated from their parents were splashed all over the TV. President Trump actually says, look, you know, we're working with countries in Central America to stop illegal migration, not because we want to keep these people out of our country, but because we are humanitarians and we want to dissuade human smuggling, and that, you know, the countries of Latin America, the problem is the migration itself, that migrants are, you know, fueling the drug problem. I mean, it was really to turn
reality on its head.
To turn that much criticized policy into some sort of humanitarian strong suit, I think was a pretty bold move on, let's say, international migration and refugees. President Trump sort of argues, hey, you know, the best thing we can do for refugees is place them near their homes so that they can get back to their home countries quickly and rebuild. I mean, that's totally ignoring the statistics that show just how long most conflicts rage for, and that, you know, calls, let's say, for Syrians to return to their homes have been made for years by the Syrian government, but I don't think many people are in a position at all to go back to their homes.
So this is what we told the SS St. Louis in 1939 when 900 Jews tried to get off the boat in New York Harbor and come to the United States, and we said, nope, you should go back to your home country, and they went to Auschwitz.
Exactly. And so I could cite a number of other examples of this, but I will say, you know, we were told this speech was written in large part by Stephen Miller, the president's sort of whisperer on the border policy, sort of the anti-migration architect. That does not surprise me at all. And there is this line that I think will be quoted in the history books, where Trump is sort of summing up his philosophy of American power projection. And he says, here's a quote, you know, America is governed by Americans. We reject the ideology of globalism. We embrace the doctrine of patriotism. Basically right. saying, hey, you know, this is much like the sovereignty message that they were using a lot last year and they're repeating again this year. Look, countries need to do everything they can to protect themselves from their critics, right? From the nagging yeah. globalists.
Lucky Lindbergh is alive and well.
Exactly. It was a pretty stunning message. And I think it's a tough sell in the UN, at least publicly. I mean, a lot of leaders come here and they speak very highly about human rights and environmental protection and, you know, sticking up for the rights of minorities. And then I'm sure they go home to their countries and do anything but that. But it is, you know, disconcerting for the United States of all countries to get up on stage and basically say we don't really care about international norms. He even said about the UN Human Rights Council, hey, you know, like we left, we hoped this council would change its policies, but they're still being mean to our many friends. You know, he wants a world where, you know, if you're close to the U.S., you're immune from that kind of criticism. It's quite a lot to take in.
Quit picking on the Saudis. It's amazing. Luke Vargas. Thank you, Luke. Good talking with you. And thank you for being with us today. It's been a fascinating day, and I think tomorrow is going to be even more interesting. This week is kind of winding down weird or winding up weird or whatever. So same time, same bat place, right, tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.